Someone's making a night of it, he said.
Well, perhaps more an afternoon. Hello, and a great afternoon it was to the podcast you're just about to hear with writer, broadcaster, and actor Charles Adrian Gilo. The many faces of Charles Adrian, impro with his Samantha Mann alter ego, devised theatre, filmmaking, most recently the excellent documentary about swing dancing, and a secondhand book podcast called Page One, which is a format that surely Radio 4 will try and nick at some point. But here he is, speaking with a wonderful emotional eloquence and openness about a passage from The Folding Star. It's half an hour of existential twinkle. Enjoy.
We hiked up the familiar paths, Dawn deliberately testing my loyalties with a good imitation of my uncle. Mimicry, like drawing, was one of his gifts, and both were literal and so at times unsettling. I responded with cowardly jabs and pinches, knowing that he would get me back later with some stifling, bare-breasted wrestling hold. It was still quite early, and we wandered across the network of summer paths, scuffed and scrawled through the dry grass. We didn't want to pitch our tent in the dark, but felt self-conscious about doing so whilst walkers and lyrical late kite flyers were still about. Probably the best place would be on the far side, the way Dawn came from home, where there would be shelter by the copse-like remains of ancient hedgerows. We circled back to the pond and sat on the bench, eating our scotch eggs and watching anglers packing up their gear. The boys among them trudged away with their rods and folding chairs like little old men. Behind them, the silhouettes of pines and poplars were reflected, and the sunset opened canyons of pink and ultramarine in the pond's muddy depths. "Better look out for the folding star," I said. "What is this folding star?" said Dawn, with the annoyance of hearing me keep saying it and having pretended before that he understood it. "Don't you know you're Milton?" I said pityingly. "The star that bids the shepherds fold, as when the folding star arising shows his paly circlet. Dear me." I put an arm around his muscly shoulders and squeezed. "It's when you know you've got to put the sheep all safely in the fold." He shrugged himself free. "What about putting the boys all safely in their tent?" he said. "Yeah." I couldn't actually see the star in question, but maybe it was best to set about it. I was always spoiling things with my quotations. He saw them as a kind of sarcasm against himself. The pilgrim took about 5 minutes to put up. Dawn dived into it as if scoring a try, and when I looked in through the flap, he seemed to have taken up all the space. I felt he'd laid a claim to it that I would never be able to challenge. I slid in alongside him in the Macintosh-scented gloom, shocked by the lumps in the ground. "It's a good job we like each other," I said, slipping a hand between his legs and stroking his balls through the soft cotton of his tracksuit bottoms. "Just think. Nice, Antibes, Jean-les-Pins." Each name said with savoured French oral vowels. He rolled onto me with a fierce grin that faded into a stare, lips parted, holding his breath, then sighing it out suddenly over my face with a hint of sausage meat and hard-boiled egg. He was working his stiff cock against my thigh. I ran my hands over his lightly sweating back and down under the elastic to the damp cleft of his arse. He curved his spine, and my middle finger just reached and drew a gasp from him as it touched his tender muscle. An outlying root of the ancient hedgerow pressed harder and harder into my back, as if to register a serious objection. I struggled out from under him, and he took it as a turn in the sex tussle till I said, "I'm just going outside for a minute." I peed into the bushes and then strolled a short way across the hillside. In the late dusk, the blanched, feathery heath grasses looked almost luminous against the darkness of the woods. I sat on a round tump, it might have been a tiny tumulus, and looked out at thin cloud and distant lights. I'd never been this far this late, hearing only the rumour of cars on the London road, the patter of leaves like rain that slackens and stops. Tonight was like being given the keys to a bridal suite. We had come up here with an unwitting blessing. My lover and I. I wrapped the word around me like a stole. The wonder of having a lover. I saw us for an exhilarating moment from outside, the amazing thing we had done. Other boys at school had girlfriends, of course, and left you in no doubt about what they did with them. But what tawdry affairs those were. You saw them hanging around the shops at Saturday lunchtime in a stumbling embrace, as if each had to drag the other along. And how confident and independent we were, how we'd struck home to the real thing. I looked back at the tent, dimly illuminated from within by a torch and the shadow play of dawn on all fours inside, getting it ready for the night. I fell into an awful blank puzzlement at times about why it had to be him, and panic at the thought of hitchhiking alone with him to Jouan-les-Pins, so at his mercy in those dusty roadside waits, the duty to keep up our spirits, my condescension and his touchiness. It might be very nice to be doing it with another boy, like Turlough or Hall, but they, of course, had shown no interest in seducing me. I saw myself deliberately twisting my ankle very badly, just outside Calais, and having to come home.
Thank you. So there's a lot going on here, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it does echo a lot of what's going on in the novel, but the themes are... A lot of the themes are there of connection with another person, of the fear of this other person, not quite feeling comfortable, but yet wanting them, is very strong.
I mean, in the sex tussle, I just love that. Do you think that sort of comes out because what is could be, perhaps, is meant to be something sort of slightly erotic? Which is suggested by the beginning, you know, between his legs, stroking his balls through the soft cotton of his tracksuit bottoms,
yes,
becomes quite quickly something faintly nauseating. With the hint of sausage meat and hard-boiled egg.
Absolutely. It's not romanticised at all. I mean, anyone who's had sex in a tent, I'm sure, can attest to the fact that it's not comfortable. I haven't had sex in a tent. I would love to have the opportunity. There's no pretense that it's easy to have sex. You know, at the age of 17, you automatically have this amazing, brilliant sex that people do talk about as if it's happening. And maybe some people do manage to have this wonderful, scent-free sex. But people, you know, other people smell. And there is, you know, our bodies aren't necessarily adapted to lying on the ground with roots digging up under us, and we're not necessarily so deeply in love that we forget all the discomfort and the needs of the other person and all these kind of things. I mean, I like that, you know, Dawn working his stiff cock against my thigh is a moment where it's not Edward's pleasure that is that is uppermost there. So he slips out, and there's that wonderful misunderstanding where Dawn thinks, oh, you know, this is all part of the thing that we're doing, and Edward's actually going,
I
really need to get out of this tent now.
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, I don't feel comfortable here. Mm. And I identify with that moment when you're with another person and the communication is not working properly, or you realise that you're experiencing different things. And it's supposed to be, you know, if you read the right kind of literature, it's supposed to be the most wonderful moment of coming together, and it very often isn't. And so I do like that, and I like the fact that Dawn is perfectly content with that. There's no, you know, there's also no feeling of, there's no particular feeling of failure either. That's absolutely fine. And Dawn is quite happy, I think, to imagine hiking across France with Edward later on at some point. You know, having this kind of experience. That's fine.
Mm. I mean, I don't know the character, because I haven't read the novel, but it seems to me that to a certain extent, what he's sort of struggling with is that he's he's a little bit sort of too, he's sort of a bit too much in his head, as it were. And
yes,
and Dawn is just able to, I mean, in every single way, and
yes,
perhaps in his enjoyment of food and
yes,
and everything, he's able to be in his body.
I think that's right. Yes, absolutely. And that's probably another reason why I like it, because I think it's an interesting problem, and I think I'm not the only person who experiences that. How do you get out of your head and into your body? How is it that some people that you meet are just apparently able to act spontaneously and instinctively? One of the other things I like in this is the fact that Edward considers that what they are doing is so much more, I think, creative than his classmates who are going out with girls, because that's the expected thing. And that would never have occurred to me as a teenager. Where I went to school, homosexuality was so wrong, it virtually didn't exist. It was just an impossible thing. And I love the idea that it could actually be quite a glamorous thing, because it's so way out, it's so beyond what anybody else is experiencing. I like that very much. But yeah, again, I remember sort of seeing boys at school and thinking, wow, they're just responding to their stimuli, and I am not able to do that. And I was aware of that at the time, that everything had to be filtered for me. And for other people, they just, you know, they felt like doing something and they did it, or they felt like saying something and they said it, and it worked, and that seemed to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dawn's one of those.
Mm.
He just happens to be gay, which is also wonderful.
There's a bathos to all of it, because, you know, here he is thinking we're being incredibly sophisticated and we're not just sort of hanging out around the chippy. But at the same time, what are they doing? I mean, they're basically going camping.
Yes, you know? And I think they're on Hampstead Heath, actually. They're okay. Just in a tent on Hampstead Heath, the two of them. I know, nothing very exciting is happening.
Yeah. The other thing I was wondering about this, where he talks about, you know, my lover and I, tonight at last I was being given the keys to a bridal suite. We had come up here with unwitting blessing. My lover and I wrapped the word around me like a stole. The wonder of having a lover. I saw us for an exhilarating moment from outside, the amazing thing we had done.
I think I have a problem, and more I have a problem with that sensation, because I feel like it takes you away from what is actually happening. Because it's entirely happening in your head, that. And it's entirely a creation. Based not on experience, but on things that you've read or things that you've heard about, I think. And so you're just saying, oh, this wonderful feeling I had vicariously when I watched, you know, this film or read that book. I am now in that. I'm that character. I'm there. And of course, you're not really. And this it's so clear here, because he really isn't. This is not Love's Young Dream out there on the heath. But I said, I definitely. I've experienced those moments of going, oh, wow, here I am with my lover. And then I think the corollary to that is the bump that comes
when
you go, oh, hang on, wait, this isn't how the story is supposed to go.
Yeah.
Maybe we are always... I try to do it less and less, because I think it is possible to decide to do it or decide not to do it. I think that's within our power.
But isn't that sort of the fantasy of love? And allowing yourself to dive into that pool of fantasy. Mm. Isn't that half the fun, or three quarters of the fun?
Well,
90% of the fun.
Yeah, it might be part of the fun, but I think that I have a different dream of being able to really come face to face with another person. And for that person to really come face to face with me and take away all the fantasy element of that, and to say, actually, what's so wonderful about this is that you don't seem to mind me, and I really don't mind you, and you're on my team and I'm on your team. That for me is a more beautiful state than this slightly fragile romantic cloud.
Mm.
That we can get lost in. I don't. I'm not trying to say we should strip that away altogether. Mm. It is fun and it's great, but it's not. I think ultimately it's.
But that moment you've just described, that moment of mutual recognition, you see, I think we're maybe talking about the same thing.
Okay.
Because for me, that is
right.
That still has a certain fantasy to it, because is it mutual recognition?
Yes,
or are you,
maybe.
Or are you in some way projecting
yeah, maybe.
Part of yourself maybe. Onto the other person anyway?
Yeah.
But I absolutely agree with you. I mean, that for me is the charge.
Yeah. I'm looking for something that is not vulnerable, something that is not fragile. That may be a mistake on my part because I'm scared of things collapsing and coming to an end.
Yeah.
I think I often make the mistake of when I meet new people I like, of trying to sort of let them know all the bad things, to sort of say this is me, this is the bad, which is in its own way unrealistic. But I'm also I'm always very pleased when if I start going out with somebody and I notice they have a habit that annoys me, I often enjoy that moment because I think, oh, and it's okay, it's still all right. I still like them. That's a sort of minor triumph. And that's romantic for me. But yes, you might be right. That's probably still part of the same. It's the same kind of fantasy, or it comes from the same problem, which is the inability, I think, just to be in the moment and just to react to what's happening right now.
But also, there is a distance between these characters. I mean, there doesn't seem to be really a. There doesn't seem to be a sense that Dawn is actually. Seeing him,
no,
and really kind of knowing what he's about.
No, that's right.
Whereas he seems to be seeing Dawn. He seems to have some sense of what Dawn's.
Yes, I think that's right. That may be a sort of storyteller's conceit, of course, because I think we do that when we tell stories about other people, don't we? But I think that's true. That's certainly the impression that we get. And don't forget, they're 17. You know, when you're 17. You tend to take whatever is available, don't you? You know, there's somebody next door who go, oh, well, they're, you know, they seem to like me, I seem to like them. That must mean that they're perfect, or that this situation is perfect.
And I suppose also if you know, your choice of potential lovers are the people at school.
Yeah, exactly. People used to say this to me, my friends used to say this to me, it's no wonder you're single, Adrian, because there are just so few gay men. You have a smaller pool to pick from. I don't really accept that as an explanation, but I think it's a nice, it's a sweet attempt to make single people,
really
single gay men work better.
In London,
no, exactly. I think there are quite a lot of us, actually.
Let's continue reading.
Yeah. A man was standing about 30 yards away, staring at the tent. I thought he hadn't yet seen me, despite the little eminence I was on. The khaki glow of the canvas and the bobbing, rump-shaped shadows thrown across it from inside held his attention entirely. He stepped forward cautiously, stopped, turned his head to catch any sound. I was fascinated by his thinking himself the observer, unguessed in the dark, and chilled by the freedom it gave him, the unhindered time he had to spy on us or to do us worse harm. He saw me, seemed to ponder for a while what to do, then started slowly in my direction. I thought it would be absurd to move away, but stood up as if I'd been spotted in a game of hide and seek. And waited with my heart thumping in my chest. I thought he might be a kind of night ranger who could tell us to move on, frighteningly without a uniform, so that we wouldn't know whether to obey him or not. He stopped again a few feet away, slightly stooping forward to mime his curiosity. "Aye," he said tentatively. A loud owl call came from the wood, and then another, further off. I couldn't tell if they were real or people signalling. I knew real ones always sounded like imitations. He turned his head towards them, and the faint cloud gleam showed steel-rimmed spectacles, a white square face with swept-back, dark hair. "Someone's making a night of it," he said. The voice was troublingly cultured, with a hint of drink blur. He wasn't aware of the long pause that followed as I worked out how I could escape him in the dark. I'd played and stood about all over here, but the dimensions and positions were vague at this moment. "Looks rather tempting, don't you think?" He felt slowly, amusedly in his breast pockets, and brought out cigarettes and a lighter. "Do you smoke?"
"No."
It was an anxious little cough. "No," I said again. When the lighter flared, I saw him lit up for several seconds. Black leather jacket, grey jeans a bit tight round the midriff, the ghoulish chiaroscuro of the face above the flustered flame, wishful dark eyes lifting to make out what they could of me. The image floated on the moment's blackness that followed, suspended in the dry warmth of French tobacco smoke. "How old are you?" he asked. 18, I said, adding on a year as if I'd been challenged in a pub. And then, with a tenuous politeness I thought would protect me, "How old are you?" 30, he exhaled ponderingly. 3. Even more than I'd expected. I felt it like a sinister disgrace, being out in the night with this person. The menacing vagueness of his intentions, the seedy self-confidence of the queers out in their secret element. I'd better walk off quietly towards the tent. "Why don't you come over here?" he said, with a new intimacy and tenseness. He swung his cigarette arm out in a casual shrug of possibility, but stayed where he was, as though not to waste the effort if I wasn't interested. "Well, suit yourself. I'd like it if you'd like it." I couldn't associate the voice with anything to do with desire. It was like being propositioned by an announcer on Radio 3. "No, thank you," I muttered offendedly. And then, to my great surprise, "My father's very ill, actually." He took this in with another glowing pull on his chitane. Shit. "He's only got a couple of weeks left to live," I explained carefully, though it was myself I was explaining to. He threw his cigarette away into the dry grass, and I watched anxiously in case a fire began to crackle round it. There hadn't been rain for over a month. I wanted to criticise him bitterly for that. "Hey, hey, hey," he whispered heedlessly as he came up close. My face was stiff. I wasn't actually crying, just breathing out through my mouth in brusque sighs. When he put an arm around me, I was hugged into leather and smoke and beer. It was horrible, but remotely consoling, the firm clutch of another world that could take me if I let it. He stood and rocked me as if I were crying. I felt pinched and self-conscious, not being able to, the vessel of tears sealed up tight inside. I slid my arm woodenly across the stranger's back. I thought, if my father could see me now. "Edward? Edward?" A low, querying call. Dawn's unmistakable form, the swish of the grasses in his hesitant approach. The stranger smudged a kiss by my ear at the moment I broke away. "No, no," I was saying, almost under my breath, as I hit at his arm and half stumbled in my desire to get free. "Edward?" both of them said. Dawn was triggered into the sudden belligerence I found both unnecessary and exciting. "Fuck off," he said to the man, with a short, spittly chuckle. "Okay, okay," backing off a pace or two. "The kid's upset, okay?" A wariness to his tone, as though he'd heard this before. He began to walk away and called back, "He just wants looking after." "Fucking queers," said Dawn, with another incredulous laugh, and then peevishly to me, "He can fucking look after himself." I couldn't answer that. I felt lost and utterly unknown. "It doesn't matter," I said. "He didn't do anything." I turned back towards the tent. If only we were in our respective homes. If we just put the tent up one morning in the garden to see how it was done. I hated the tent and the hours to come, with Dawn squashing me and nowhere to escape to but the night and its predators. I wouldn't say anything about it now, but I felt I could reasonably get up at first light under the pretext of writing a poem. When I looked back, I could just make out Dawn running very fast across the slope, the retreating stranger peeping round at the last moment as he brought him down with a quick, easy tackle, got up, and jogged back. Beyond them both, on the crest of the hill, figures were moving among the trees.
it's got a sort of, particularly the end. I mean, the ending. It's got a surreal quality to it. Why does he run and tackle him?
I think it's funny because when I first read this, I think I interpreted that as Dawn going after the man in a kind of enthusiastic way. I think it's just a alpha male thing. I think he's just protecting his man. I think Dawn's just, he just wants to attack this guy. So it's not so aggressive. He just rugby tackles him. But I think there's something playful about it. I think Dawn does not see this as being something, you know, nothing serious has happened. It's just some guy who's come over and hugged his boyfriend. I think that's all. Edward's the only one who experiences this as a disturbing moment.
And yet it's interesting that both of them position themselves in a kind of an us-them
yes.
way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Edward talks about the seedy self-confidence of the queers out in their secret element.
Yeah.
And then Dawn also has, you know, yes. has a crack with yes. the fucking queers.
Yeah. I think this is entirely my own reading into this, but I think that's to do with the interiorization, the internalization, I should say. I think it's to do with the internalization of that what a queer is a guy who has random sex on the heath, and he's not a guy you'd want to know. He's somehow dangerous to society, not only to people, but he's morally suspicious. Whereas these two are in love. In schools, teachers are encouraged not to talk about homosexuality in any positive way. There's a definite feeling that the homosexual lifestyle is not a good thing. And so I think that's what
something
this is about. It's something predatory and dangerous and will lead to the downfall of civilization. And so I think that's what they... And that obviously... so there is something dangerous about these guys out in the woods. They're older. They're preying on, in a Daily Mail sense, they're preying on these 17-year-olds, and the 17-year-olds are not. They're not part of that. They're part of the good society. They're part of the nice society. People may not know that they're in a relationship, but they're accepted by their friends and family, and they think of themselves as being okay. I think that's what that's about. But in the context of the novel, I think it's really an amazing moment because Edward Manners is 33 during most of the novel and pursuing a 17-year-old. And so this is the moment when we finally go, oh, no, hang on, maybe this is not okay. I feel like...
The 33-year-old.
His trousers are a bit too tight around his midriff, which I understand as to mean he's putting on a bit of weight. He's
shock horror.
33 is old. It's older than Edward expected.
How old are you, Adrian?
I'm 33. Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely no weight around the midriff. I'm just sure anyone who's listening and worrying.
Yeah, because it's a concern, I think, for a lot of people whether or not they have weight. I can only respond as me. This is how I read it. But I think he is a vaguely threatening presence, this man. It may, without Dawn's intervention, have led to something else happening. And there is that moment where he's comforted by the guy. But it's almost despite himself he's comforted by the guy, I think. I don't feel like he's ready to enter this adult world of seduction. I don't think he has the tools. I don't feel like he feels he has the tools. He's already vulnerable in his relationship with Dawn, it may be that deep inside he's saying, yes, I would like to have sex with this man on the heath, but I don't read it quite that way. I think he's saying, I don't quite know how to say no, I don't feel like doing this.
And that did come across in your reading, in the sense that he did sound, the way you read it, and I loved the inflection you gave to the character. I mean, he sounded quite sort of menacing.
Right, and I don't think that's true either. That's me being... I couldn't find a good voice for him. I don't think he is menacing. But I think he knows what he wants and Edward doesn't. Mm. What I find interesting about that, in the context of the novel, is that Edward, as an older man, tends to assume that the 17-year-old he's pursuing also knows what he wants. And I think in this passage, we're just asked to say, okay, maybe not. Maybe we need to, you know, step back a little bit and say, okay, perhaps there's more going on than we're aware of. And, you know, although it's easy for us just to cheerlead for the person we want to win, in a sense, there's a bit more at stake.
And what is at stake?
I think in a more general sense, what's at stake is a kind of confidence in oneself and the feeling that the world is an okay place and it's not going to hurt us, and that love and sex isn't going to hurt us. And I think that's something that is a fragile thing, especially as a teenager, and I think even later as well. But I don't know why. There's something about being a teenager and not understanding, I think, one's self and one's place in the world that can lead one to take risks that have effects much later on, I think. And there is something different, you know, the pain that Dawn might inflict or might not inflict, who knows, is one thing, because they're the same age. Mm-hmm. But that this man who knows what he wants might come along and seem to offer something and want something else. That's a dangerous thing, I think. That comes with the risk of real harm psychologically and emotionally. What the other one, what Edward needs here is comfort, I think. And he's losing his father, and he doesn't know how to deal with that. And I think in this encounter, he wants a hug. I feel like that's what he wants, that's what he gets, and that's what he wants. The man wants to have sex with another man, and that's where the problem is for me. So the, you know, then you get this whole question of consent. What does that? So when, you know, because sex and comfort are, they're two different things, but they can feel the same up to a certain point. And I think it's not, you know, I think there are, I certainly read, you know, accounts by teenagers where, you know, they, in retrospect, they said, I should never have had sex with this person, but I felt like they were looking after me, for example, or I felt like that, you know, that it seemed to be a comfortable thing to do. And then at a certain point, I changed my mind and said, no, I don't want to do this anymore. And it continued. And that, I think, often stems from a deep misunderstanding of what it feels like to be in the other person's shoes. And I think as we get older, we do become less vulnerable in that way.